non-recognition of the People's Republic of China has been the stated policy of our United States government for 10 years now. As recently as a week ago, last Thursday, our Secretary of State, Mr. John Foster Dulles, reiterated the opposition of our government to any recognition of the People's Republic at this time. Speaking in San Francisco before a convention of foreign affairs analysts and experts, Mr. Dulles spoke these words in defense of the American policy. Developments make it ever more clear that if we were to grant political recognition to the Chinese communist regime, it would be a well-nigh mortal blow to the survival of the non-communist governments in the Far East. Such recognition and the seating of the Chinese communists in the United Nations would so increase their prestige and influence in the Far East, and so dishearten the free nations, that the communist subversive efforts would almost surely succeed. But it is certain that diplomatic recognition of the Chinese communist regime would gravely jeopardize the political, the economic, and the security interests of the United States. The Pacific, instead of being a friendly body of water, would in great part be dominated by hostile forces, and our own defenses would be driven back to, or about to, our continental frontiers. 3 weeks ago, the International Department of the National Council of Churches of Christ in America held a world order rally in our city. This study and discussion group was attended by 600 delegates representing the 33 major Protestant denominations numbering over 38 million congregants. Mr. Dulles is not only our Secretary of State, but a man of high rank in the councils of the National Council of Churches of Christ. He expressed his own feeling of the importance of the deliberations and the debates of this world order group by appearing before them on the first night of their convention to state again and to defend his formulation of American policy. After 5 days of meetings, the 600 delegates came together and summarized their findings in a 5,000-word report, which they entitled A Message to the Churches. In this report, they rejected Mr. Dulles's contention that the non-recognition of the Chinese government is an integral and essential part of our foreign policy. In reference to this problem, they wrote, "Christians should urge recognition by our government of its policy, reconsideration by our government of its policy in regard to the People's Republic of China. While the rights of the people of Taiwan, that is Formosa, of the peoples of Korea should be safeguarded, steps should be taken toward the inclusion of the People's Republic of China in the United Nations and for its recognition by our government. Such recognition does not imply approval. These diplomatic relations should constitute a part of a much wider relationship between our peoples. The exclusion of the effective government on the mainland of China, currently the People's Republic of China, from the international community is in many ways a disadvantage to that community. It helps to preserve a false image of the United States and of other nations in the minds of the Chinese people. It keeps our people in ignorance of what is taking place in China. It hampers negotiations for disarmament. It limits the functioning of international organizations. We have a strong hope that the resumption of relationships between the peoples of China and of the United States may also make possible a restoration of relationships between their churches and ours." This rejection by the World Order Group of a policy of the United States government a policy in large measure formulated by a man high up in their own council should not be taken by us lightly, as it was not undertaken lightly and without a great deal of sober reflection by the leaders of the World Order Group. These men are not publicity seekers. This rejection was not done in search of newspaper headlines or some sensational news release. These 600 delegates represented a cross-section of the most respected and substantial members of the church community and of the professional and business communities of America. And their rejection of Mr. Dulles's non-recognition policy merits certainly our considered judgment. If I may be permitted to interpret the premises on which their rejection is based, and I have read the entire report of their message to the churches, I would say that it is based on two main factors. The first is largely concerned with the facts of this particular situation. It is pragmatic and to the point. And it would emphasize that our current policy of non-recognition is unrealistic, that it is pointless, that it is fraught with grave danger of our involvement in a major war. And I believe that the second major premise on which they formulated this rejection of our policy of non-recognition is more general in scope. It involves their feeling that much of our current policy is overly doctrinaire, overly moralistic, too inflexible, too unrealistic, too determined to rest our search for peace on rearmament and on the power of massive retaliation, too unwilling to sit down and to negotiate bit by bit and block by block the problems which confront our people and all the peoples of the world. And I should like to discuss these two premises with you here this morning. The People's Republic of China, which we commonly refer to as Red China, assumed the control of the Chinese mainland during a bloody civil war which ravished China between the years of 1946 and 1949. In 1945 and 1946, before the outbreak of that civil war, the United States policy favored neither the party and the policies of Chiang Kai-shek and his Kuomintang, nor the party and policies of Mao Tse-tung and his Communist Party. We knew that both these parties were based on autocratic rule. Neither of them had been freely elected to power. Both of them tended to be tyrannical. Both of them had frustrated to a degree our efforts to combat the Japanese in China during the Second World War. We also knew that even though the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek had come to power in the mid-20s and early 30s, on a policy and a platform which bespoke an atmosphere of Western liberalism, their 20 years of power had done much to shatter our hopes that they might bring needed reform and Western ideals of law and order to the Chinese people. Their years of power had been years of unbelievable venality, corruption, incompetence. And partially because of the Japanese invasion and partially because of their own limitations, partially because of their own needs to seek and to grasp power, the high ideals which we had held for the party of Sun Yat-sen and later Chiang Kai-shek had pretty well been dissipated by the facts of their rule. And so in 1945 and 1946, the American government, for the most part, contented itself to try to prevent a bloody and, in our view, useless civil war. We tried to arrange a coalition government which would include members of both the adherents of Mao and the adherents of Chiang. Now, intransigence on both sides brought about the failure of these negotiations. And during the early years of the Civil War, we, for the most part, kept our hands off of the Chinese situation. We saw no reason to support the one or the other. The two groups seem to be just two more of the groups of competing warlords who for centuries had despoiled and ravished the Chinese countryside seeking the treasury and the power which rested in Peking. And we did not want in those days when we were thinking of retrenchment and demilitarization to involve ourselves in a hopeless Chinese morass. It was only once the defeat of Chiang Kai-shek in 1947 and 48 was evident to all that the United States government for the first time saw reason to involve itself and to ally itself with Chiang. And the reasons for this change of heart had remarkably little to do with the Chinese situation itself. You remember that these years, 47 and 48, were the years in which America woke up to the fact that we were in a world with countries still grasping for power. And we identified our enemy as a force which we called international communism. An event such as the Berlin blockade and the attempts of Russia to gain access to the Mediterranean and to infiltrate the Near East. All these events caused us to ally ourselves with any party and any group in any place of our world who seemed to be opposed to forces that were communistic or were labeled communistic or espoused a Marxist doctrine. Now, historical research has pretty well shown that during these years, the Russian government gave surprisingly minimal service and military help to the party of Mao and to his armies. And yet the policies which Mao Zedong espoused for the reconstruction of China were definitely Marxist. They were collectivist. They were dictatorial. They were based on Marx and then Lenin and Stalin. And all of a sudden we found ourselves as allies of Chiang in a holy crusade against the extension of communism into Southeast Asia. The very moment then when Chiang had committed his troops to a last futile battle to control the upper Yangtze Valley, America threw at least its emotional support to his side. And though he was an unreconstructed warlord and nothing more, we suddenly clothed him in our minds in the shining armor of a knight fighting in a holy cause. His cause became ours, and his defeat became ours. When in 1949 Mao came to Peking and his government assumed the reins of power, we refused to recognize that government because we continued to hope that situations might be remedied, that this temporary defeat might be turned into an ultimate victory, and that as Napoleon once had returned from Elba to be raised again by his cheering troops to the leadership of the French Empire, so Chiang might be returned from Formosa to the leadership of the Chinese troops, we would be able to overthrow a regime which we now had no reason to want in control of the Chinese mainland. Our hopes unfortunately proved futile. In power for 20 years, Chiang had not been able to win the loyalty and the admiration and the support of any group of the mass of the Chinese population. Out of power, he seemed just another deposed warlord. And Formosa has been the traditional refuge of these warlords who have lost in the battle for the control of the throne of the empire. The Chinese people then were unwilling to recall to their bosom a man whom we devoutly hoped they might recall. Though we lent him our moral support, our economic support, our military support, the counter-revolution, which we hoped would break out in China once the tyrannical nature of the communist government had become self-evident, this counter-revolution was simply not to be. And I believe that most hard-headed analysts would have assumed that once the Chinese government of the People's Republic had shown its ability to stabilize a situation, to assume control of the provinces, to put down and suppress all the dissident elements in the population, this was the moment in which the countries of the world should have recognized this government as the de facto existing government on the mainland of China. But we were adamant. We resented having our cause defeated. And though we had done, in fact, precious little to gain victory for the forces of Chiang, we now continued to make Chiang feel that if in time he were able to lead again an amphibious attack against the mainland or find in the mainland a party of sympathizers who would raise him to power, we were wholly and totally committed to such a policy of counter-revolution. And we continued this policy of non-recognition as our symbolic gesture to Chiang, which we said to him, we are with you if you can engineer a coup which will reestablish you in power. As the years, as the days, as the months passed by, any hope of Chiang's return to power diminished. And soon the United States government found itself in an anomalous position. We were committed economically, by treaty, by military aid, to the support of Chiang, to the defense of Formosa, and we had encouraged, and encouraged again, his thoughts of reconquest. But we found, as we looked practically and realistically at the situation, that there was little hope of this reconquest. And our military leaders told us that if Chiang were rash enough to commit his troops to the mainland, it would be to a defeat. And not only would he bring defeat upon himself, but he would involve us in a Chinese war, which we lacked the manpower to prosecute successfully. And even if we were able to prosecute successfully, would inevitably involve us in the morass of an immediate thermonuclear and global war, something we devoutly hoped to avoid. And so by 1950, just 1 year after Chiang had been forced to retreat to Formosa, President Truman had to order the 7th Fleet into the Formosan Straits, in part to protect Formosa from any amphibious attack by Mao, but in larger measure, to protect the United States from any rash attack by Chiang against the mainland of China, an attack which would inevitably have committed us to his support and equally inevitably have committed us to a war which we did not want and which we could not win. And there has been ever since this ambiguous and ambivalent nature in American policy. On the one hand, by continuing the theory of non-recognition, we have encouraged, at least tacitly, Chiang to believe that his moment of reconquest will come, and that if he chooses, he has an American marker which permits him to commit his troops with the full knowledge that America stands ready to support that commitment. And on the other hand, with the exception of a few months in the first days of the Republican administration of 1952, America has been committed in practice to the containment of this tiger cub on Formosa, because we know the consequences which any rash act of commitment on his part would have for us. We hope to unleash Chiang, but to unleash Chiang against China is to unleash a mosquito against a modern, technically trained, nuclear-powered army. It is simply not to be. And in practice, we have had to eat our words, though we have never retracted our words. And in that, the world order and I believe we have made our cardinal and most unrealistic error. Twice in the last 10 years, we have had a chance to see how perilously close to the brink of war this emotional commitment which we have made to Chiang through the non-recognition of the Peking government has brought us. When Chiang retreated to Taiwan, his army was able to retain control over three series of small offshore islands, Quemoy, Matsu, and the Taichens. In the early years of his Formosan government, Chiang used these islands to mount small guerrilla attacks against the mainland. He used these islands to unleash propaganda barrages against the mainland. He used these islands to send his spies and his messengers from there to the mainland. During the Korean War, our own unofficial intelligence agencies used these islands to our government's advantage. Obviously, as the military buildup of these islands continued, Mao Tse-tung could no longer allow this irritant to continue unchecked. In September of 1953, Mao began an artillery barrage against the Taichins, against Kimoi and Matsu. And Chiang immediately cried, "You have promised us your support. My territory has been violated. Commit yourselves now. Allow me to bomb these artillery emplacements. Allow me to bomb the supply depots of these artillery emplacements." And if we had allowed this, there would have been an Asian war. And in our own country, especially among the military who advocated, some of the military who advocated a preventive war policy, there were cries that now was the moment for a showdown. Now was the moment to unleash Chiang against the mainland, to reconquer China from the Chinese. In January of 1954, the little island Vichyang in the Taichins was attacked by an amphibious invasion of Mao Zedong's troops. Apparently, this island was a particularly disturbing hornet's nest to the Chinese coast. And again, the cry of support was raised. Again, Chiang cried out, "You have committed yourselves to protect the integrity of my territory. Protect now my territory. Involve yourselves in a Chinese war." And only the presence in Washington of a few cool heads prevented our involvement in that war. And again, this year, this fall, we have seen that the military buildup of Kimoi and Matsu has so disturbed the forces of the People's Republic of China that they have again brought to the light this irritant to them. They have begun to shell the island. And again, we have walked that narrow precipice between war and peace, between a war which we do not want, which we cannot win, a war over a little piece of an island 2 miles square, 4,000 miles from our mainland, without strategic value to us, to the Formosans, or to the world. We walk this precipice because we continue to permit Chiang to believe that he is a legitimate governor of the Chinese people, because we permit Chiang to continue to believe that whatever crusade he is able to undertake against the Chinese mainland, we encourage, we will support, and we will help to prosper. Such then, I believe, is the reasoning which has led the World Order Group to espouse a change of policy on our American government's part. They recognize fully that such a change of policy would be difficult for us to swallow, but we would have to swallow our pride. They recognize that we have had great and good reason to be angry and to be irritated by the People's Republic of China in the past 10 years. They bloodied our noses in Korea. They fought our troops to a standstill. They published the unwarranted, purely propagandist charge of germ warfare against us. And that charge got great adherence and acceptance in many parts of the Asian world. Surprisingly, they were able to win the allegiance of some of our prisoners of war. And we have never been able to understand how American young men would prefer remained in China than to return to their homes. We have spoken a great deal about the capacities of brainwashing and the subtle psychiatric and psychological techniques that the Chinese used against these men. We have been irritated by the whole process of communization of China because we disagree fundamentally with the despotic, inhuman, tyrannical, collectivist aspects of that policy. And we allowed in our own domestic affairs Senator McCarthy to equate the recognition of China with communist appeasement and to silence for years any spokesman who cried out for a more realistic policy vis-a-vis the Chinese people. All this the World Order Group knew. And yet they also knew that unless we succeed in restraining Chiang to Formosa, and reminding him that he is the legitimate governor of this area, and not the legitimate governor of China itself, that unless we recognize China and accept it as one in the body of world nations and impose upon it the responsibility of international law, which such acceptance implies. Unless we succeed in demilitarizing these few offshore islands which can tomorrow force us into an unwanted war, unless we succeed in removing this danger-fraught situation from the list of irritants, causes of peace, causes of trouble and tension in our world, unless we succeed in the near future of doing that, each year, each brings us closer to war, and each time we come to grips with the China situation, we are less capable of adjusting to the newness of the situation. We are less capable of compromising our position, for we are more and more committed emotionally and in fact to old policies, old ways. I agree with the logic of the World Order Study Group. Though we may not like to accept the fact, the Chinese government of the communists has gained wide acceptance in the China mainland. The Chinese have never known a liberal government. For two millennia now, they have been ruled by despotic emperors. And the loss of their liberty is not a matter of great moment to them as yet. But they have had in return a vision of a great future. A group in power which for the first time in a century has been able to stabilize the currency, to increase industrial production, to increase the opportunities for education, to raise the standard of living, to do something about agrarian reform. For the first time, they, as the individual, the mass, the farmer, the coolie, the peasant, the student, has been able to see in the policies of the government a vision of the great China which he loves and of which he dreams. Though we may not want to admit it to ourselves, the Chinese government is, for the near future at least, of the People's Republic, here to stay. And I think we will have to agree with the summarization of Professor John King Fairbank of Harvard University, the head of the Chinese department there, who in his recently revised volume on the United States and China has had this to say. One consolation in this crisis, therefore, is to think that the Chinese communist dictatorship does not represent the interests of a large enough portion of the Chinese people, that it maintains itself only by force and manipulation, that in fine it is too evil to last. This can be endlessly debated. Some will argue that the new order is not viable. Such, I fear, is not the case. Peking's collapse is always a possibility, but at present we have little reason to think it probable. What we see in the mainland China is a new, all-powerful bureaucracy coercing the populace, but drawn from it for that purpose. A new elite urging on their labors, organizing their lives. This new totalitarian system has profound evils built into it, but it has remained viable in Russia. A less thorough and more superficial autocracy grew viable under one Chinese dynasty after another. We cannot conclude that Chinese communism's obvious evils are likely to be sufficient to destroy it. Clutching at this straw will not help us. In short, we have to face it. The recognition of China does not imply any approval of the Chinese way of government. I have no sympathy with its dictatorial and tyrannical methods. I have no sympathy with its Marxist and collectivist philosophy. But we are not in sympathy with many governments whom we recognize. We recognize, after all, the parent of all communist governments, the Soviet Union. We recognize Franco-Spain and the Dominican Republic and Tito's Yugoslavia. We have no sympathy, certainly, with any of those governments. Recognition simply implies that a government is in control of a particular geographic area. And as one of the body of nations, it must be brought into contact with the rest of the nations, and if possible, agreements on minor problems and on major problems must be worked out with that government. We cannot force the peoples of the world to accept a form of government which to us seems right, for manifestly the peoples of Asia are not prepared for the type of democratic rule which we have achieved. You cannot expect that people who yesterday were 95% illiterate who yesterday did not own the simplest commodity, who yesterday had no vision of the technical age and of its philosophies and of its needs, to accept overnight a highly sophisticated type of Western government which demands an educated electorate, which demands mass literacy, which demands scientific know-how which they cannot as yet command. It may be that this type of primitive agrarian communism which we see developing in China is but the first step in an evolving political pattern which may someday lead to a more democratic or liberal government. It may be and it may not be. It may be that Chinese traditions, Confucian, statist, collectivist will not permit this. But in any case, we simply cannot play the ostrich and put our heads into the soil and say, a country strong and growing of 600 million people does not exist. We will have nothing to do with that country. For you know, an outlaw makes his own law. You cannot expect the outlaw, the gangster, to abide by the police regulations and the civil rule of a country or a community. To outlaw China is to permit it to continue to make its own law, to bring it into the body of nations, into the collective council of the nations, is to impose upon it the restrictions of that international body. And I agree with Professor Quincy Wright, who has written that it seems likely that stability and peace would be served better by bringing the most populous state of the world and the greatest power of Asia into normal relations with the United States, the United Nations, and in the world community, than by treating it as an outcast. For as long as we continue to treat China as an outcast, we free it from any responsibility to international order. We freed it in Korea from the Geneva Convention because of that. We free it from the responsibilities of engaging with us in the difficult negotiations towards disarmament, towards the control of thermonuclear explosions. We free it from the obligation of sitting down with us at the bargaining table to discuss the difficult problems of Timor and Matsu and the Formosa Straits, of the mandated territories still along the Chinese mainland. Major and minor, we have no means of communication with the Chinese government until we recognize it and impose upon it a necessary two-way system of telecommunication. This, I think, is the reasoning which has led the world order, and it certainly has led me to believe that continued non-recognition of the Chinese government is unrealistic, at this stage pointless, and fraught with grave danger. I spoke of a second premise of the World Order group, and that was their premise that this policy of non-recognition is symptomatic or symbolic, if you will, of much that is too negativistic, too doctrinaire, and too moralistic in our current American policy. In the message to the churches to which I have referred, the World Order spoke words which will have a familiar ring to you because you have heard them often from this pulpit. Words which emphasize the need of a policy seeing beyond power to peace, seeing beyond the possibilities of massive retaliation to the necessity of immediate conference and compromise. Adjustment, seeing the need of recognizing our responsibility to live in a world of both friends and competitors, to live successfully and at peace in that world. I should like to quote to you a few paragraphs from the message to the churches. Stronger efforts should be made to break through the present stalemate and to find ways of living with the communist nations. Sometimes this is called coexistence, but we are concerned with something more than the minimum meaning of that word. Our relationships with the communist nations should combine competition between ways of life with cooperation for limited objectives. Our resistance to communist expansion goes with recognition of the fact that communist nations as nations have their own legitimate interests and their own reasonable fears. We should avoid the posture of general hostility to them and cease the practice of continual moral lectures to them by our leaders. And remember that this is a church group speaking about a church leader. In the Cold War, we allow ourselves to drift into a defensive position in which we hesitate to admit any imperfections in our society, lest it confirm the communist indictment. Thus, we inhibit the self-criticism which is essential to the health of a democracy. We tend to make opposition to communism the touchstone for policy both in domestic life and in international relations. There is real hope that new generations within the communist countries will be less fanatical in their ideological convictions, and that they will be more preoccupied with peace, with economic well-being, and with tentative experiments in cultural freedom, and with the attempt to dominate other nations. It is not to be expected that they will formally renounce what we consider to be their errors. It is enough for the kind of living together described above if their emphasis and priorities change. The establishment of good relations will require tireless negotiations with them and imaginative programs of communication, cultural exchange, and personal contact. It is not enough to deplore war and to call for its abolition. We must engage and encourage our country to engage without reservation in things that make for peace. Though military peace in the non-communist world remains a necessity, its limits should be more clearly recognized, and far more of our attention and our resources should go into the task of helping nations find their own ways to solutions of their social and economic problems. And they repeat, it is not enough to deplore war and call for its abolition. We must engage and encourage our country to engage without reservation in the things that make for peace. I submit to you that this is one of the finest statements of a new look in American foreign policy, one which I heartily commend and feel is much needed. It is not one which deplores strength. It is not one which deplores the need of defensive armament. But it is one which emphasizes the need to go beyond the negativistic elements of our policy, to admit the realities of our world today, a complex set of nations, some willing to accept our leadership, some willing to accept the Russian leadership, some earnestly seeking a neutralist position where they can accept simply their own ways of living and of alliance. We will have to live in a very complex world, a world which will not easily or willingly follow the moral or the political or the military leadership of one side or of the other. To adjust to this world, we are going to have to begin to develop the techniques of peace, not the armaments of war. What are these techniques? A healthy analysis of the situation as it exists. An unwillingness to continue any policy which smacks of subversion of other nations. An unwillingness to keep our heads in the clouds and deny that the situations have so changed that much that we might want to see happen cannot happen. And a willingness to sit down at the bargaining table, bit by bit hammer out the clauses of contracts of compromise. Contracts which will permit us to live with both friend and competitor in a world destined to find its life in peace, not its death in thermonuclear war. Amen.